coming up on Open Source with Tony Motley, international communications consultant Amin Sidhu explains how culture and economics impact the global food system and biodiversity.
Trying to feed people in the future as our population grows in a nutritious way is going to be a big challenge, and we're already seeing that. We're actually seeing it more right now. I think it's just looking at things in a more systemic way and having those discussions about that. And I think probably the ones now are looking at supply chains and food supply chains. The way that they have been created are global.
Welcome to Open Source with Tony Motley. My guest is Amin Sidhu. She's worked on the issue of biodiversity in the United States, Central America, South America, and Europe. Amin joins us from the south of France. Amin Sidhu, welcome to Open Source. Amin, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you joining us. Biodiversity, what does that mean?
Biodiversity, that's a good question. Biodiversity is, it's not just related to food and agriculture, which is more of my specialty, but it's really looking at the diversity of all things biological. So that's biodiversity could be the earth, the soils. It's also related to different species like animals. But in my world, I guess biodiversity for food and agriculture is having a diversity of different types of foods and vegetables, and not to get too scientifically focused on this conversation, but even within each type of food, having a diversity in that. For example, maize, which is quite a staple crop at a global level, but also I know it's a big crop in the U.S., and there's different varieties of corn, for example. So that would be considered biodiversity when you're looking at the diversity of the genes and the way you plant them and the kind of the different tastes that come out of those different kinds of different crops. So I'll leave it at that before we go to technical and scientific.
Okay. And that's interesting. Now, you say in my world, what world are we talking about? What kind of things are you working on that involve food and biodiversity?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I guess my world is your world, which is everyone's world, and it's the world of food and agriculture, which I think is important and close and dear to a lot of people's hearts, because you know food is something that we need to talk about in terms of getting food on the table, but it's also something that's very cultural and very traditional, and so it's got very different layers and different dynamics with it. Me specifically, I've worked in the area of food and agriculture more in a global context for maybe the last almost 8 years. And this is really looking at different institutions and agencies that work in the area of food and agriculture. So that's ranging from the United Nations organizations that work on the topic of food, that look at accessibility, that look at trends, that make sure that we can offset potential famines in the future and those kinds of things, looking at different aspects related to culture, people, equality, poverty. I mean, there's kind of all different dynamics related to that. But essentially, you know, how are we getting from seed? And people say farm to fork, but I think, you know, farm is part of it, but it's even going down deeper into the soil and getting from the seed to your plate and everything that along that process to ensure that that's happening and ensuring that's happening in an effective way, in a way that's equitable for everyone along the food chain and in a nutritious way as well.
Do you ever touch on the issue of GMOs?
Yes. I mean, this can be quite the controversial topic. And I think many people listening and many people that even work in this area, different aspects of food and agriculture will have their own insights and perspectives on this. Where we work now, not so much where I'm working now at the moment, which is work at the Food and Land Use Coalition. But before that, I was working at an institution that was a research center that was focused on a lot of biodiversity. And I guess the short answer is there's kind of it's hard to put black and white on an issue like many issues in the world, and I think GMOs is one of those where they get a bad rep because of some of the bigger corporations and some of the exploitation that comes with that. But I think there are some benefits to that as well. but now, I won't go down. We don't need to maybe go down that route.
But I'm just curious, as a consumer, and we're all consumers, how can a consumer identify whether this is a, quote, good or bad GMO?
Huh, that's a good question. I don't know, actually, Tony. I mean, I think as a consumer, I think it's very difficult to know in general what's good and bad. I mean, I think the amount of information, we live in an information world right now. So we are fed through different channels of news and information and blogs and podcasts like we're doing today. We're having conversations with different types of people. And that's definitely a source of information on swaying our opinions and informing us on which direction we want to go and take when it comes to food. I think another thing that's quite distressing and I think the intentions are good, but I think can be even for someone that works in this area is labeling. And I think we have everything from fair trade to organic to local. And I know like GMOs have their labeling on some products as well. And it's very difficult to know when you're standing in, you know, even the chocolate aisle, to understand what is the best chocolate. I mean, are you going for the one that's, there's probably not a locally produced one, but is it the one that's fair trade and it has fair trade stamp on it? Or is it the one that's organic? And what does that mean? And I think it actually can get quite stressful. And sometimes I just go for the pretty packaging and try to avoid all the excess writing, which maybe a lot of people do.
Yeah, I think people have their own choices. And I think if you really want a chocolate bar, I don't think you're going to really read the label. You're going to just buy chocolate, unfortunately. But I guess, you know, a little bit of chocolate is not going to hurt us, I imagine. You know, you've lived in a lot of different places around the world. And I know that culture impacts food. Food is a part of the idea of culture. Talk about how you've seen culture influence what's on our table and what our eating habits are as you've traveled.
Yeah, thanks, Tony, for that question. And I like this question a lot because I think many people can relate to this. And I think it starts for me, my journey with food and this different these different cultures and traditions start from just my childhood. And that's really a combination of my grandparents who are Indian and they were born and raised in India, actually as farmers. And then it's a combination of my parents who grew up in the UK and then overlaid with a third dimension of me growing up in the US. And I think having that, you know, one day would be lentils and stewed vegetables with chapatis, with another day maybe would be shepherd's pie or something like fish fingers and sausage, relating to kind of more of a British cuisine, I guess, if you want to call it that. And then of course, American cuisine, which is actually quite diverse and international, especially if you're living in a metropolitan area. And I think, so growing up, and that was kind of my lens from kind of an early age. And then I think one of a defining moments for me was studying abroad in Mexico and really kind of making the distinction in real time that, you know, Taco Bell and these Tex-Mex chains were not necessarily giving justice to what Mexican cuisine is and the way that food is put on the table and prepared and where it comes from and the different types of dishes and what they represent in different occasions. Another, I think, big moment for me was actually, and this was a longer time that I lived, was in Peru. And that was in a rural environment. And it was very much part of the community. And I think beyond the actual food, I mean, we ate very delicious foods and it was a range from vegetables and meats and different starches, it was actually a real lesson in food loss and waste. And I think that's one of the topics. I know it's a hot topic right now in the world, but also in places like the US and Europe, that it's this disparity between, you know, there's parts of the world and even parts of our own countries that have people that don't have enough food and maybe not the right foods and the nutritious foods and maybe even, you know, malnutritioned. Whereas on the other side, there's an excess of food and it's being thrown away right off the table. No one could finish their plate and it's being thrown out, or it just never even made it out of the fridge because we just had so much. And one of the lessons learned in Peru, for example, is how do we recycle this food, and how do we give it to the animals, or how do we, you know, we used to have a bucket and we'd give it to the pig, and the pig would essentially eat your leftovers, or your bones would go down and you'd give it to the dog on the ground. And those kinds of things was kind of a real time wake up call on, you know, the simplistic lifestyle and how we can be more mindful of the way that we are using our food and eating it and not wasting it as well.
And there's also an element in terms of how you have a meal, and you and I have discussed this before. Share with the open source audience about what it means to have a meal in Peru, and to, you know, you can't even get it to go necessarily. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I guess, I mean, I can only speak for myself, and I know it could vary amongst people listening and different families and cultures around the world. But for me growing up, you know, we aimed as much as possible to sit around the table and have as many meals as possible. But I think the reality was everyone was getting up at different times because school started at different times, and so did my parents' work, as well as dinner, because there was so many activities happening in the evenings that, you know, you were just eating what was left over, or hardly was there the moment where we all sat around the table and shared. And maybe that was more on the weekends, but definitely in Peru, it was again, one of those moments that you don't take things to go, and you don't have a quick cereal with throw some milk and a couple of spoons and you're out the door, but you actually sit down, you prepare a meal and you eat it and you share it and you do that together. And it doesn't need to take hours and hours, but it's something that you do and you share. And it was this whole process around the food and the way that we eat it that was quite profound for me, because especially as soon as I arrived, I was ready to have my to-go cup and ready to go, but that didn't exist. And I think that's something that also spilled over. Then actually from Peru, I moved to Europe and I was living in Rome, and I worked and lived there for about 3 years. And it was a very similar type of culture. And I think one of the things that actually enticed me to Italy and to Rome specifically was this idea of the slow food movement, which I'm sure people have heard of. And that's something that's actually become quite a global movement. And it was just the same idea of, you know, taking the time and being really mindful of the way that you're eating and the way you're buying your food and preparing it and actually appreciating it when you sit down and have a meal, and making sure that you're spending the time with the people around you, if you can, to share that meal. And that also meant, you know, as much as possible to refrain from sitting at your computer and eating your lunch, which I remember doing too many times in New York, but probably very, very few times when I was living in Rome.
That's interesting. I think also, does it matter that food is as much of a commodity in the United States, or am I wrong to say that? And it's different in other places. In other words, you know, we're in a hurry and we don't really think about food. It's just a product almost. You know, everything mm-hmm. is it different in Europe or in other places that you've lived?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting concept. I think it also just depends. It's hard, and we all do this, but to refrain from comparing, I think, national cultures, right? Because I think even within American culture, there's different places, like, I don't know, like a New York versus an Alabama versus, you know, the same in Italy. You know, if you're living in a rural zone, if you're living more in a high-paced commercial zone, and what does that mean? I mean, it doesn't mean people aren't rushing, because sometimes there are those moments of rush. And to say that everyone sat together and held hands and kumbaya'd through all their dinners is not true either. But I think it could be just related to the pace. I think some of it is, for me, it's just related to the pace. And I think it talks to some larger kind of cultural constructs on the way we work and the way things work and the way we are timed to do things and timed in a day to deliver so many hours, for example, when you're related to work or when you have a family and you're running around to different schools and activities. And it's almost like slowing down that pace and going back to the kind of slow in the slow food movement. It's almost like the slow living. And unless you have the slower living context, then it's harder to have the slow movement part of that too, if that makes sense.
Sure. Now explain a little bit more detail. When you say slow food movement, what does that mean?
So the slow food movement is something that was started in Italy, and it's kind of taken off now in different parts of the globe. And it really goes down. It's kind of that whole concept we talked about a little bit related to the biodiversity aspects of, you know, where are you getting your food, and taking and being mindful of the people and those that are taking care of the food, like the farmers, for example, or those that are picking the food and bringing it to you. It's also looking and going to maybe a market to get your food, maybe cutting out too many of the middlemen and going more direct to the source. I guess it's maybe more difficult to go to the farm in most cases for us around the world, but how can you get to an open air market or a fresh market and get the produce that's the freshest and of the highest quality? And quality being, you know, that's been maybe it means it's organic, or maybe it just means it's the best type of a variety of an artichoke that was grown. And then, you know, maybe it's costs a little bit more. So, you know, bringing all that aspect into kind of the quality of the food that you're preparing, and then of course bringing it back and taking the time to prepare it. And a lot of people will say, especially, you know, Italians will say that it's really the quality of the ingredients that will give you a quality meal. And if you look at, for example, just some of the basics of what you eat there, you're sometimes just adding a little bit of salt and a little bit of olive oil. And of course, the best olive oil you could find. And there you go. And there's your meal. And there's not too much mastery of, you know, firing up and adding different ingredients and adding different spices to it.
Now, in terms of your work and on the global level, what are the issues that are being discussed in these forums or these places with that you interacted every day?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think there's different levels and there's different aspects, you know, because I think probably the biggest thing at the moment, and it's kind of this new phrase and this new mentality, is systemic change and how that's affecting our food systems. Because as you know, as we all know, everything is connected. So it's easy to say people should eat nutritious foods, but the how is not necessarily related to just having, you know, an orange and a banana and, you know, whole wheat bread for breakfast. It's related to accessibility. It's related to inequality. It's got an aspect of economics. It's got an aspect of what's happening biologically and in the environment in nature. And you look at what's happening in terms of climate change, and that's, you know, a drought can pretty much wipe out someone's crop supply, which could then wipe out what someone potentially would eat. So I think just starting to look at these issues, and not just for food, but I think starting to look at some of our issues more broadly in a systemic nature, and realizing that just, you know, trying to feed people in the future as our population grows in a nutritious way is going to be a big challenge. And we're already seeing that. We're actually seeing it more right now, and it's being exasperated with kind of the crisis that we're in. But I think it's just looking at things in a more systemic way and having those discussions about that. And I think probably the discussions that are coming up more specifically in my area of work right now are looking at supply chains and food supply chains, because the way that they have been created are global. So whether we like it or not, our supply chains are global. And because we are in kind of a different scenario of movement, and that's just movement of people, that's movement of trains and cars and shipment, and different policies and different situations changing from day to day, that's can obviously be very disruptive to the global supply chains, which can be very disruptive to the way we access our food and how we get that. And I think it also says a lot to the length of that global supply chain. I mean, it could be something that's a local supply chain. So maybe you're just getting apples that are coming from the orchard down the street, but you may potentially be getting tuna that's being shipped in from, you know, an ocean to a processing plant that may or may not be open. And then, you know, all of the different parts along the way that are making sure that it gets to your supermarket and onto your plate.
Now, in the news here in the United States, there's a real concern about meatpacking plants, and the pandemic has affected many workers in these plants, and some of the plants have been shut down. there's a meat shortage. I think some hamburger restaurants are like Wendy's have stopped or have had shortages in supply of beef. Is the food chain broken? Some people want to say it's broken. Or how would you frame that?
So in the case of, and I don't know the specifics, and I'm definitely not an economist, and I won't try to be, but from kind of the literature and the discussions that we've been having is there's different aspects of these supply chains. And I think I kind of referred to it before. There's going to be the shorter supply chains that may or may not be impacted as much. And then these longer ones, I think in the case of, for example, I actually read some of those articles relating to some of the pork factories closing down, et cetera. It's one of the disruptions in the supply chain. So basically, if you're sending food that still needs to be processed somewhere before it can go out to the consumer, then that's going to break the link, right? So in that case, the pork factory is closed. So what does that also mean? It means on the one side, as you mentioned, Wendy's has to rethink the way that they're putting together those hamburgers and use maybe an alternative meat. It maybe means something for the consumer as well that may not be able to access that at the supermarket. But on the other side, you also have these slaughterhouses that are now backed up with hogs. And so what does that mean? And at what point, you know, when does that get diverged? When does the factory open back up? And it starts to actually become kind of a logistical, it's quite logistical, right? And this is where we're talking about food being systemic. So it's one thing is having food and making sure we can get food on the table, but it becomes a logistics challenge. And I think that's what's happening, especially most recently, is even for those that are producers, whether you're a farmer or you're a supplier within the chain, that even diverting, so let's say you're diverting your supply that was going 50% to restaurants like Wendy's and maybe some other chains or non-chains, and the other 50% to supermarkets. I think for the short term, at least, I think a lot of them are trying to divert some more of their supply to the supermarkets with you know, right now not having a clear line of sight of understanding when restaurants will be at back to full capacity again. And I think there's a lot of restrictions and laws and policies that make that not so much a seamless process. So I think that's the struggle. And I think there's also so many nuances because different countries, different states, different localities are working with different level of resources and different support.
What does this say about our consumption of meat in the U.S. and how do we compare? If you know, how do we compare in meat consumption to other places around the world?
I don't know. I would have to dig around more on the meat consumption side of things. But what I've read, and I think definitely what I've seen more recently in terms of trends and national comparisons, I mean, the United States is definitely higher in terms of meat consumption to maybe other countries. I think there's a few things that are kind of the dynamics behind that. And it's not just necessarily because everyone likes Wendy's, but I think it's also going back to the original part of the discussion, talking about traditions and cultures and what kind of food you're eating. You know, perhaps a place like, I don't know, Nepal or India maybe doesn't have a high meat consumption because it doesn't really align with the culture and the traditions and the religions, for example, is one thing. I think what we've seen definitely over the last, if not decade or last two decades, is in a lot of, especially in developing countries, the price of meat is actually significantly higher. So now that you've seen a lot of developing countries, lower income countries moving now and transitioning to middle income countries, places like China are starting to see a higher consumption in different types of meats. So I think that's a little bit of maybe the dynamics behind it. But then it could also be related to costs. And I think, you know, when you look at something that's, you know, price of, you know, I don't want to say price of a hamburger at Wendy's, sometimes it's just more convenient and people feel that it's more value than maybe getting a salad or getting something else. And this actually goes to, and there's a lot of work in this area as well, on just the economics of food and how we quantify different foods and how we price different foods. And you know, you can also still go to probably your Whole Foods and go to the organic grass-fed section and also get your beef. That's probably a lot more expensive relative to your Wendy's hamburger. But I think it does talk a little bit about, you know, what people are used to culturally, what people think is valuable and what for value for money, especially right now as we kind of hit an economic downturn. So I think there's kind of lots of pieces to that equation.
As you look towards the near future, the next 6 months to 18 months, how do you think this pandemic will affect food and the food industry as you deal with it, or food policy? How do you think it's going to change or impact that going forward?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think right now is really a defining moment. I think what's happened, at least in the last 6 months, we've seen again, looking at the system as a whole, our global system, you know, we're facing a health crisis and mobilizing around that. But second to our health and making sure our heart is beating, continuing to beat, and we stay healthy is obviously the food. And that's also, you know, it's shown throughout all societies, the essentialness of the workers on the front lines and the supermarkets, as well as the farmers and making sure that we get the food. I think it's also exposing a lot of the cracks and the fragility in some of the systems that we had, again, relating to also the food, our food supply systems as well. And I think now is a time to kind of look at those fractured areas or those disruptive areas and think about how we can build it back better. And one of the things that, I mean, we're definitely looking at from our point of view and the kind of the networks that I'm working in is looking at the global impacts of the global food supply system, because I think right now there are many critics pushing back and saying, well, perhaps given the situation, we actually need to lean in more on local food supply systems. So whether that means we're all growing our own vegetable gardens and we all have our own pigs and chickens, or doing something more locally, but you know, within our regions or our states or within our localities, or the other part of the argument is, do we stick with this global supply chain? And I think what we're pushing for and what we're saying is actually this global supply chain, not because we've set it up that way, but it's actually probably one of the most efficient ways that we continue to go forward, because of the way of what we're used to, as consumers, and just the way we've set up over probably more than hundreds of years our economics behind that. I think some of the things that probably need to change are going back now and making sure that whether you have a long supply chain or a short one, that you're being efficient along that supply chain, so that there's maybe not so many hands, so to speak, that need to touch the apple before it, you know, gets into Tony's fridge or onto your plate to eat. Or, you know, cutting out, I know, for example, in India and in a lot of the conversations we'd have with our stakeholders, that in a lot of places, there's some success stories that relate to this topic, and where some states are imposing some kind of rules and regulations that are actually making the supply chains more effective and cutting out some of the middlemen, which is not great for the middleman. Perhaps it's more effective and better for the greater good of what we're trying to achieve when we come out of this. I mean, other kind of lessons that have come out in places like China, for example, have allowed early on for these green channels to exist, thereby offsetting some of maybe the challenges that others have faced in terms of making sure the food supply chain is as fluid as possible during this kind of moment of crisis. I think there's also, I mean, there's a ton of additional work that's happening also related to subsidies, for example, and the way that we are, the economics of the subsidies and what that means in terms of pushing and producing a specific type of crop. But at the end of the day, in moments like this, I mean, how useful is that? And how useful is that setup as we kind of move to a new and more efficient system?
Thank you. Those are all really interesting and important answers that you've provided us with. And I just want to thank you for sharing a half hour with my audience on Open Source. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tony. This has been really great. I guess if I can just a few final comments is just to say, I think, you know, sometimes we do feel, and especially in a moment like this, that we don't have control and maybe we feel a bit helpless. But I think, you know, continuing to be informed about what's happening, not only in our own backyards, which is also probably the most relevant at the moment, but understanding what's happening in other parts of the world and seeing the positive stories, the success stories, and also seeing, and I don't want to call it an opportunity, but seeing a way that we can improve the way not only do we eat, but the way that we produce and interact with food. I think this could be an interesting moment to continue to engage in those types of dialogues.
Absolutely. And again, we'll just have to see what happens, because nobody knows what the future holds. But I think there is change on the horizon, no matter what you believe.
Absolutely.
So anyway, we'll have to leave it there. My guest has been Amin Sidhu. Amin is an international communications consultant. I just thank her for being here with us all the way from the south of France. Thanks, Amin. We invite everyone, if you like the show, rate the show, share the show, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you. Open Source with Tony Motley is a production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.